The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the online edition of the News and Observer, and we'll be taking a look at an article from the Washington Post as well. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with a travel scenario that has mostly been found in the realm of science fiction. But now, a Harvard astronomy professor is challenging what we may think or believe about the search for alien life. The future of the search for alien life is with Avi Loeb. He has plenty of critics, was written by Christopher Borelli for the Chicago Tribune, and it appeared in the January 13, 2024, online edition of the News and Observer. So let's see what we can discover as we begin to explore. Avi Loeb leaned in, grabbed my hand, and said, "Be as critical as you like." What, after all, was one more critic? He resembled a caricature of a scientist, his body wiry and short in a plaid tailor's suit, holding an expression that suggested both the severely etched Oppenheimer and the anxious chain-smoking lawyer Martin Short played years ago on Saturday Night Live. Certainly, that's the image many of his peers seem to hold for Loeb. One part austerity meets one part sketchy. He is a theoretical astrophysicist. He teaches astronomy at Harvard University and chaired the department for 9 years. He is also the director of the Institute for Theory and Computation, the founding director of Harvard's Black Hole Initiative, and former chair of the National Academy's Board on Physics and Astronomy. For decades, he's been known as a prolific voice on dark matter, black holes, the formation of stars. When I met him late last year at the University of Chicago, where he was appearing as part of a Chicago Humanities Festival event, he tended to avoid eye contact and look at the ground, gather his thoughts, and then gush information, a kind of astrophysical fire hose. For light elevator chat, he explained how the sun acts like a battery. Where he rubs some people the wrong way is when he starts talking about aliens. Avi is doing incredibly important work as one of our most important figures in the contemporary search for extraterrestrial intelligence, said Garrett Graff, a longtime journalist on national security and a Pulitzer Prize finalist, whose latest book is UFO, the Inside Story of the U.S. Government's Search for Alien Life, Here and Out There. But also, I think, a lot of what's controversial about him stems from his peers who think Avi becomes either too flip with his science or crosses the line from skeptic to advocate. They say Loeb is outlandish and disingenuous, prone to sensational claims, more interested in being a celebrity than an astrophysicist, not to mention distracting and misleading at a moment when the science community is defending its very foundations. For his part, Loeb, age 61, rarely lets a criticism pass unattended. The search for alien life became his life's mission, in a way, exactly one decade ago, when on January 8, 2014, a fireball crashed in the Pacific Ocean off Papua New Guinea. Several years later, after Loeb and Amir Siraj, a Harvard undergraduate, picked through the United States government's data on the speed and movement of the fireball, Loeb told interviewers it could be interstellar technology, piloted by artificial intelligence. By then, though, he had already made headlines after a long cigar-shaped object, since named Oumuamua, or Hawaiian for Scout, passed by Earth in 2017. Loeb theorized that, considering the trajectory and quickness of the object, it could be alien technology using a light sail, boosting speed with sunlight the way sailboats rely on wind. Many more scientists argued it was naturally created, perhaps a rock or a comet. Scientific disagreement tends to be polite. But Loeb, with little encouragement, complains of scientists who criticize him without doing anything themselves. He complains of science driven by jealousy, egos, and drive-by opinions. He says the public is more interested in discovering that there is life beyond Earth than, say, pouring multi-billions into particle physics research at facilities like Fermilab outside Chicago and the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. He said during our talk that considering the billions and billions of planets in the universe, any search for intelligent life would be less speculative than discovering new particles. At the Humanities Festival, Loeb told moderator Dan Hooper, a senior scientist at Fermilab, that particle colliders just confirmed old news from the 1960s, how particles interact. Hooper countered that scientists know more about physics since building colliders and that Loeb is misrepresenting how scientists feel about research and the scientific process. Loeb responded that the intent of Large Hadron was to find particles it didn't for $10 billion. Avi Hooper said, "One of us on this stage is a particle physicist, and it's not you." The audience collectively squirmed, and yet that conversation about extraterrestrial life was happening and among all academics was telling. Now, sitting between Hooper and Loeb, almost symbolically neutral, was Graf, whose approach to the search for aliens is as practical and sober as Loeb's is eager. He's a former editor at Politico and Washingtonian Magazine. He's authored deeply researched, nuanced histories about September 11th, Watergate, and the federal government's plans to survive a nuclear war. To see him at a scholarly event in Hyde Park beside a Harvard scientist, even one as controversial as Loeb, is a portrait of how seriously the discussion about UFOs has become, particularly since 2017, when the military and CIA came forward to say, yes, there are flying objects that they cannot readily explain. "I am not a lifelong UFOologist," Graf told me later, or ufologist, if you want to say. "I am not even deeply schooled in pop culture about aliens, but while covering national security, I saw the topic move to the fore in such a way that it was a serious topic of serious consideration among serious people. When people like former CIA Director John Brennan began talking about it, you got interested. I mean, scientists can be humble about whatever they know and don't, but it's a lot harder for a government bureaucrat, or government bureaucracy, I should say, to say that we spend $60 billion a year on intelligence, $800 billion on national defense, $100 billion on homeland security, but there is stuff up there, and we don't know what it is, and we do not want to tell you that." For much of the 20th century, the search for extraterrestrial life and UFOs, or rather, as the government rebranded them, UAPs, for unidentified aerial phenomena, had been the territory of fringe amateurs, Hollywood filmmakers, and tabloids. To see a scholar as solidly mainstream and institutionally rooted as Loeb wade willingly into UFOs was rare, but not unheard of. As Graf's history details, some of the more meaningful research on the search for aliens has emerged out of Chicago's intellectual community. J. Allen Hynek, a Chicago-born astronomer who later chaired Northwestern University's astronomy department, was a former UFO skeptic whose investigations for the U.S. government's Project Blue Book led to his founding the Center for UFO Studies in 1973. The group still has the Chicago headquarters. There's also Frank Drake, another Chicago-born astronomer, who pioneered the foundation for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He formulated the Drake equation, which aimed theoretically to calculate the likelihood of extraterrestrial life using the number of planets that could sustain life and advanced technology. It was, in a way, an answer to the Fermi paradox, which was born out of a conversation in 1950 among scientists at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Enrico Fermi quipped something like, "If there is so much life in the universe, why haven't we seen it?" Loeb, it goes without saying, is Team Drake. During his time in Hyde Park, he swung by Nuclear Energy, the Bilbus Henry Moore sculpture of 56th Street that commemorates Fermi's construction of the first nuclear reactor. He recalled reading Fermi's papers as a young student. As anyone who's seen Oppenheimer knows, he was probably as responsible for the success of the Manhattan Project as anyone. He understood both the theory and experiment. Oppenheimer was more of a theorist and manager, which is why I've been puzzled by the Fermi paradox. He asked in an Italian accent, "So where is everybody?" But who would stand in their home and decide there's nobody next to me, therefore I am alone? At least look out a window. Fermi didn't even bring a telescope. Would aliens visit him in Los Alamos during lunch hour? They could have visited Earth millions of years earlier. It's a very bad question. Well, indeed, as Graf said, historically the problem with the conversation around UFOs has always been too binary and simplistic for even the smartest minds in science to arrive anywhere meaningful. People think UFOs aren't real, so therefore aliens aren't real, or aliens are real, therefore UFOs must be aliens. Carl Sagan himself, a University of Chicago alum, decided if aliens come here statistically, it's every 100,000 or 200,000 years, and so statistically, it's unlikely that was an alien you saw last Thursday night. Well, Loeb pictures himself occupying a grayer area. In his recent book, Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars, Loeb writes that he can think of no scientific discovery that will more fundamentally transform our civilization and brighten its prospects than the proof we are not the sole technologically capable civilization in the universe. But he wants hard evidence. So, in 2021, he co-founded a research program using funds from private donors to find and identify alien technology in the vicinity of Earth. He wants to apply rigorous scientific method to locating and analyzing objects, moving UFO research away from blurry video and iffy anecdotes. It's not for nothing that he named his Harvard-based initiative the Galileo Project. Loeb reminds himself that lots of scientists were controversial in their own time. Galileo spent the last part of his life under house arrest for showing that the sun was the center of the universe, not the earth. After his paper on Oumuamua came out in 2018, an Italian reporter asked if he felt like Galileo, pushing back against conventional wisdom. "I told her that I didn't," Loeb said, "and yet there is that common thread there among scientists who want to break the mold. I mean, it's better now. I am not under house arrest. People want to feel like they're at the center of the universe. That was Galileo's problem. For me, it's showing that there might be someone else out there. It's not about whether we are the physical center of the universe than the intellectual center. All I'm saying is, let's look at evidence." Even SETI radio towers were about, more or less, waiting for a phone call. But what if nobody's calling at the same time you're listening? Loeb is, in a sense, taking a very long view, placing himself in historic company. Maybe he's hard to deal with, and maybe he's not the kindest to those who disagree, and maybe he's glib with pronouncements. But do you want to play inquisitor to his Galileo? I asked if, in a way, any research on extraterrestrial life requires an iconoclast, someone willing to upset. He replied, "We all die eventually. What is the point in pretending otherwise? The most powerful kings, all powerful in their times, they also died, like all of us. The fundamental fact about our existence is that we are not that important, and science wants to say it is important, and so it needs to present a powerful image, and I'm saying forget about that. The posterity and self-importance, and let's just figure this out." Talking with him, it's easy to see how well-meaning intentions get buried under rhetoric. It's also easy to see why, despite his gravitas, some colleagues refuse to peer-review his papers, traditionally a major part of the process. Loeb grew up on a chicken farm in Israel and found his way to science during compulsory military service with the Israeli Defense Force. He describes himself even now as a curious farm boy. He said he was traumatized at family dinners. He would ask hard questions and get bad answers. The adults in the room pretended to know more than they knew. They could not admit when they didn't know. I became a scientist to answer questions myself. That I became chair of Harvard Astronomy is irrelevant. I am a farm boy. I maintain my innocence in the sense I refuse to be one of the adults in the room. He returns again and again to colleagues who call me names, but never call for more funding for his research. He pictures the Galileo Project expanding into an international network of research stations and telescopes. But that demands funding, albeit a fraction of what's been spent on particle colliders, he said. He's raised $5 million. The Netflix cameras that followed his expedition last year to find bits of the Papua New Guinea fireball could quicken imaginations and lead to more money. He faces headwinds, he said, but He could also be the right person for this job. Graf describes the project as a mix of science, spirituality, politics, and national security, requiring both believing and holding counterintuitive ideas in your head all at once. We're at least 70 years on from Drake's first work with SETI, he said, yet we are not appreciably closer to solving this mystery. In fact, we are probably not going to have answers for several decades or several human lifetimes. It could take centuries, and there is something to me that is beautiful about being part of a human effort that vast. Before Loeb left Hyde Park, an elderly man approached him, not willing to wait. Avi, he said, we have to find life before I die. Loeb smiled and said, well, I'm working on it. Well, let's move from the search for alien life to more earthbound travel topics. SLO County Coast Guard veteran and family are set to sail around the world on a catamaran. This article written by John Lynch for the Tribune News Service. It appeared in the January 13th, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. When U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Adam Leggett retires after two decades of service next summer, it'll be the end of one chapter of his life, but not the end of his time on the seas. Leggett, a native of Arroyo Grande, who is now stationed in Washington, D.C., said that while retiring from the Coast Guard is bittersweet, it allows him to pursue his dream of circumnavigating the world in a sailing ship full-time. I've been dreaming about sailing and surfing my way around the world since I was probably a freshman in college, Leggett said. The plan was I was going to do my 5-year commitment to the Coast Guard, buy a boat, get out, and then just take off solo. But my senior year, I ended up meeting my now wife, and plans changed. Since then, Leggett has expanded his dream to bring his family along with him, he said. Now, Leggett, his wife Brandy, and children Aria 12 and Harbor 6 are excited to embark on the first leg of their multi-year globetrotting adventure later this year aboard the SV Kakoa, a 46-foot catamaran, Leggett said. I think it took me over a decade to convince Brandy that this was a good idea, and probably the last 5 when she really got excited about it, Leggett told the Tribune. Coast Guard veteran puts experience to use. Leggett mastered sailing over the course of a 20-year career in the Coast Guard, during which he served on 6 ships across 9 locations, including San Diego, Detroit, and Sheboygan in Michigan, as well as Homer, Alaska, and Stuttgart, Germany. I pretty much tried to spend as much time on ships as possible, Leggett said to the Tribune. It was really what I loved doing, and I was passionate about it, but it was hard work, oftentimes thankless. I was gone from my family quite a bit, and I sacrificed a lot. He initially joined, and by the way, he was a former surfer, and he joined the Coast Guard out of high school for the benefit of a free education, taking a role that would keep him close to the ocean. Leggett said over his career, he got the exposure to the sea he was looking for, accumulating more than 11 years of total time spent on water. Leggett's first assignment in the Coast Guard wound up being his longest to date. Over the course of 6 months, he circumnavigated the globe, albeit from the relative comfort of a diesel-powered vessel, he said. Once the journey's underway, Leggett said he hopes to revisit some destinations he passed through during his service, but with far more time to visit on his hands. Now, family gets its sea legs ahead of a long voyage. Now, Leggett is preparing to transition his and his family's lives into their vessel, the Kakoa. Leggett said he bought 20-year-old Dauphin 460 in 2021 when he and Brandy decided to commit to a long-term journey, and he has since worked to refit its interior into a home on the ocean, renaming the ship in honor of his late dogs, Kai and Koa. The coming voyage won't be anything like Leggett's 6-month trip of the world in the Coast Guard, he said. One of the endeavor's earliest hurdles will be adapting the family's life to life sharing the Kakoa's 3 staterooms, 2 restrooms, bunks, and a small office, Leggett said. As part of his transition, Adam and Brandy are selling most of their possessions, cars, and home, and will take advantage of technology such as Starlink's internet satellite service to keep their kids connected to school. So far, the family has taken a pair of short trips from the eastern seaboard to the Bahamas and the Cocoa, conquering seasickness and getting their sea legs, Leggett said. Leggett said he'll personally have to adjust to being a full-time navigator, sailor, and teacher to his kids, all while keeping the boat together as the only member of the family with significant sailing experience, but he thinks he can handle the increased responsibilities. At a minimum, the family could be on the journey for the next 5 years, but could stretch as long as 8 years, depending on their enthusiasm for the lifestyle, Leggett said. As part of that journey, Leggett said he and Brandy plan to document and broadcast their international adventures online as a means of keeping friends and family in the loop on their travels and generating some side revenue to support the journey. We got a lot of flack for bringing our children, Leggett said. People hear about what we've been doing and ask, why would you do that? Why would you endanger your kids? Your kids are more likely to die in a car accident on the way to school than they are to be injured crossing an ocean, he replied. Where is the Kaikoura headed? Well, the family will move aboard the Kaikoura on May 1st to sail up north to the Chesapeake Bay to learn to live on the boat together. In November, they depart for the Bahamas to kick off the journey itself. In the coming years, Leggett said they'll try to visit as many unique locations as is feasible, but listed Japan, India, and parts of the African continent as some potential destinations. Speaking to the Tribune on December 30th, the family's last day in Leggett's hometown before returning to Washington, D.C., to serve his final 6 months before retirement, Leggett said he'll miss the Central Coast in the years to come. This will probably be our last trip here for an unknown amount of years, Leggett told the Tribune. Our goal is not to get around. Our goal is just to go voyaging and see the world, to want to make my kids people of the world. And by the way, the Leggett family's adventures can be found at their website, svkaikoura.com. That's svkaikoa.com. And also on Instagram, at svkaikoa, svkaikoa. Quite a journey, and I'm sure we'll hear more in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. And the Leggetts, by the way, aren't the only family planning to do some unconventional family travel. WRAL News recently posted the story of a Cary couple sells everything to live on a van for 2 years, and this was posted on the WRAL.com website. And it says, the Dragos will be living in a van for 2 years while they drive from Alaska to Argentina. They sell everything to begin this two-year trip. And then we read, a Cary couple selling everything, taking off in a van for a two-year trip in the Western Hemisphere. Brenna and Jason Dragos got married in December. Now they say it's time for a new adventure. The couple said they plan to sell everything in their Cary home. They will be living in a van for 2 years while they drive from Alaska to Argentina. Living day by day, or day to day, is exhausting, Jason said. And sometimes it feels like you're just going through the process. The Dragos family holding an estate sale at their Cary home to fund a two-year trip in the van. We don't want to live the same day over and over again, Brenna said. We want to be creators of our life. The couple hopes to leave by early spring, and they plan to videotape their journey and post it to their social media. The estate sale will continue until everything's gone. The estate is located at 1117 Wake Robin Lane in Cary. So there you go. We'll be following that family, I'm sure, in some future episodes. Now, writer Stacy Lasto is going to wrap up today's journey on Armchair Traveler. She has a story entitled Around the World in 26.2 Miles, written for the Washington Post, published August 3, 2022. In 2012, shortly after crossing the finish line of the Rock and Roll New Orleans Half Marathon, Laura Butterfield filled up on oysters and Bloody Marys. It was Butterfield's first out-of-town race and her first time in the Big Easy, and her strategy was simple. I'll commit 2 hours or less to running around. I'll see interesting parts of the city, and then when I'm done, I'll eat everything in the city and have a great time. The communications executive, who relocated to Belgium from Chicago during the pandemic, met friends in Valencia Spring in 2021 to run the marathon and has plans to run the marathon in Medoc in October. Now, during a stint in Japan, Butterfield flew to Seoul to run the marathon and spend a long weekend in South Korea. Runners who love to travel and travelers who love to run have been getting passports stamped and bucket list checked one race at a time. For many, the destination race serves as an impetus to travel somewhere new and stick with a training regimen. The first time I ever set foot in Vermont was ostensibly to run the 2012 Mad Half, but even though I somehow placed third in my age group, I credit the small field of participants. I didn't care so much about my performance in the 13.1 miles as I did about visiting the Green Mountain State. The first marathon taught him more than how to run a race. Though I've yet to race internationally since the Vermont Half, I've run marathons in Duluth, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, Los Angeles, and Corning, New York, along with roughly 50 half marathons around the country. For me, post-race indulgence, local beers almost always on the menu, and bragging rights. After all, it's kind of cool to run a marathon outside of your hometown. All of this is part of the charm. And so more so when the BQ, that's the Boston Qualifier I'd been chasing, eluded me time and time again. Elisa Cohen, founder of Lux Travel Club, a boutique travel agency, said that most of her marathon traveling clients are novice runners who like the athletic component, such as a vacation affords. Now, planning a trip around a destination race adds to the whole excitement of marathon training and is a great way to see a city and build a trip around it, Cohen said, noting that Paris has become a popular destination in this regard. Spencer Farrar's first international race in Scotland in 2006 hooked him on race travel. I had a little interest in bagpipes at that time. A lot of my races are quite honestly determined based upon location, said Farrar, who works for a private equity firm and splits his time between Hawaii and New York City. More and more, he said, the majority of his travels is running-related. Farrar's favorite race destination is South Africa, where he has run the Comrades Marathon and Ultra 9 times and is about to run his 10th later this summer, and that would have been in 2022. The itinerary changes with each visit. Although Farrar said he's planning to stay in Cape Town again, one of his favorite cities, which he called a foodie paradise before venturing to wine country. Two of New York attorney Ruth Gursky's most memorable race travel experiences took place in Sydney and Amsterdam, respectively. As a participant of the Gay Games, a sports and cultural event on a mission to promote equality, Gursky made these events part of a larger plan to discover different cities. It's fun to meet other athletes from other countries and visit new countries. I never would have gotten to Sydney, otherwise it's a long trip, Gursky said. David Killian, officer of site selection for the Federation of Gay Games, said a lot goes into choosing the game's location. In addition to ample city support and ability to put on the games, Killian said, having the right destination is an important part of it. Although the organization is not so concerned about whether the location meets the vacation criteria, participants, Killian said, it's been pretty hard to get people from all over the world excited about going to a small city. Doug Thurston, race director of Big Sur International Marathon, which draws runners from more than 24 countries in all 50 states, said, building and running as a kind of part of your vacation experience is now more popular than ever. Citing the growth of marathons in Southeast Asia, Thurston said, now you can build an international travel destination bucket list of nothing but cities and marathons in all of these cities. So quite the workout coming up there in these travel scenarios, and I'm sure as we proceed, we will be following other events and some of these runners who like to travel as well. So that'll be fun to keep up with them, and from probably some places maybe we haven't even heard of before or covered in previous episodes. Let's wait and see. Well, my friends, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I remind you, the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. If you have comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.